Good morning, everybody. I know that it's an early start to the day, so thanks for being here. We were just talking as well, that at this point in the weekend, right, everybody's at breakfast and at the meals really connecting with folks around some pretty deep things sometimes. So it's also hard to just be in a very live, real conversation and then be like, I've got to go to a seminar, see ya. So thank you, everyone, for being here this morning. What was interesting is they actually asked me to pick a topic that was really on my heart, you know, about 8 months ago to speak at this conference. And so it just at the time and still, I'm just intrigued by this sense that we are a people that really want to drive forward and we really want to be a voice for the voiceless. We really want to stand for the oppressed. And, you know, we're kind of go-getters, right? Like we're activators in the room. So to even kind of ask us to come to a retreat weekend, it's not your typical church group that's like, I'm just going to go lay on the lawn for 2 hours. This is a group that's like, give me some more, you know, juice. I'm ready to go. And so I was noticing even by last night, I could tell some people were kind of like a little antsy as we were worshiping, maybe ready to get back to things today. But it really has become this common thread that I have been seeing that having been in this, working in this issue now for 10 years, that there are both wonderful joys that I'm seeing of people who are really kind of learning how to balance a lot of the stresses and the pressures of this kind of engagement with this injustice, about how to find joy in the midst of such darkness. But I'm also seeing some pretty sad stories, which is people who are what I would call burning out or tanking in a lot of ways that is very harmful not only to themselves but to the people around them. And so I think this morning I hold very dear because it's just my own personal journey and I really wanted to share about what it means to kind of sustain in the long haul, and it's not like I have all the answers, but I do feel like just by who I'm seeing here is in the room, you get that there's a sense in each of us, I think each of you know, that it's like if we are going to be about this, I loved how Justin the first night said, this is not something new. This is about us returning to what God's always cared about, right? So we see God as being able to be constant and to be able to be so powerful and strong, and we believe that his power is in us. And so there is that sustaining power, but I do think at times we can get caught up into a bit of a, whether it's a Messiah complex, whether it's a martyrdom sense, whether it's a just kind of sacrificial, this is just what I need to do for others, and all of a sudden you're losing relationships in your own life. And so just recently, this last Monday, I went and spoke at Stanford on self-care. And so I'm at this, you know, kind of secular university in a secular environment, but really trying to talk about all these layers of us that get engaged with this issue. But 8 weeks into a quarter on human trafficking, when these students have never heard of the issue of human trafficking before, I mean, I'm sitting before students that are just shell-shocked, right? I would say in 60 seconds now, if not 60 minutes, you can go on YouTube, websites, watch a video, and you can be absolutely bolted to your chair in despair. I mean, the videos that are so graphic about how violent and brutal sex trafficking can be, how extensive some of these labor trafficking situations are, the sense of isolation, loneliness, physical scarring. I mean, people just are sitting there going, you know, it is a traumatization that is happening to people who are willing to open themselves up to this issue. And so I'm sitting there and I'm looking at these students and they're all just kind of like, and I'm sitting there going to talk to them about self-care. And I started asking people, I'm like, you know, has this been one of the hardest quarters for you at Stanford? You know, and some of the other students, I said, you know, let's just be honest. Have you increased the amount of time that you felt like you just haven't wanted to do your normal social activities? Or has your drinking increased? You know, issues on a college campus that it's like they might not even realize what it's tied to. I said, have any of you broken up with your boyfriend or girlfriend? I mean, this the way in which people start to wrestle with how this impacts their relationships. So that was just Monday. And so I can see that even 8 months ago when I was like, hey, I'd love to talk about soul care and how we sustain. And then even just this Monday of saying, wow, you know, as we just, when you have somebody who's eager to learn more about this issue, they are the very people that are the most susceptible to burning out. So I have people come to me from churches all the time and they're like, I am the first person in my church to really like know about this issue or care about it, and I want to bring it to the greater community at my church. So, you know, you guys gave me this list of DVDs and I'm going to go home and watch 7 videos on trafficking this week because my committee needs an answer by next Monday as to what movie we're going to watch. And then we have this huge marketing campaign and we want to get 100, you know, 300 people there. And I just sit that person down. I'm like, no one should watch 7 human trafficking videos in 7 days. Let alone, a lot of people are doing it on their own, right? They go home and they're like, I mean, I was susceptible to this. I would go home from a full day when I first started working for International Justice Mission, and I'd be like, you know, I never saw Hotel Rwanda. And I would sit down and watch Hotel Rwanda. And then the next day I would get up and I'd be talking to people about children in brothels. And then I would, you know, the next night be like, you know, I hadn't seen. And I mean, I was just beating myself up. It was almost once you open yourself to being receptive to saying, God, my heart is breaking for what breaks yours. We also have to understand that there is a limit to how much we can handle at one time. And it's okay to say, I need to just not see that right now. Even last night, we were talking about the movie that they showed last night. And even by the title, right? Hardcore. I just knew in my soul yesterday, I did not need hardcore last night, right? I had just opened myself up to God this weekend and said, I would love to just kind of have a space of letting the ampedness that I feel like I've been living at kind of come down. And that was kind of the last thing I needed, was to just all of a sudden then be sitting there and be like, oh. But there's a sense you can get as a leader in this movement where you say, I've got to know what the latest movie is that's been out. People are going to ask me for a review. You're kind of Siskel and Ebert of the, you know, of the human trafficking film world. And so the similarity for me was one of the things I do on the side that I consider one of the ways in which I really keep joy kind of pumping into my life is I've been the Stanford women's basketball announcer for 15 years. And I had played college basketball. And it's, you know, it's about 15 nights between November and March that I go into the stadium and I sit down. And I'm kind of the gal that sits at half court. And the team comes out and I say, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Maples Pavilion. And it's a blast, right? And it's so just about the sport. And, you know, once in a while I mess with people in the stands, and I have had some pretty funny bloopers. Outback Steakhouse, I called it the outhouse. And that was 5 years ago, and they've never let me forget it. Everybody's like, I'll see you at the outhouse after the game. But I do that partly because, I mean, yes, I played basketball and it's a part of my identity, but I just do it as a way to keep connecting with a place where I just kind of need to show up and not always be about the deep, right? And not be about these things. And it's been amazing, the relationships that I've made there. And then when we've been on the radio or on TV because of our human trafficking work, the amount of basketball fans, they come up to me and they say, now I heard you on the radio, but you weren't talking about basketball. And it's like they almost can't listen to what it was because it's not their subject, right? But these things that we can connect ourselves to so that we make sure there are those places and those outlets of joy, that is not just time off. That is an essential part of our walk in learning how to be disciples of Christ, where not every moment we're having to just put the nose to the grindstone. And I think that's different for everyone. It doesn't necessarily have to be an athletic outlet. But I think we all have those ways where we could say, what are those things that, sometimes it's been a discipline for me. It's been like, you know, do I really need to keep doing the Stanford announcing? And I'm like, you know what? This year, I think I need it more than ever. Because right now, when I'm thinking I don't have time for it, that's probably the very thing I need to make time for. And it's been a wonderful journey for me. So, you know, 10 years ago, as of next month, I was actually at grad school at Stanford, I was in international conflict resolution, which I always say is highly interesting but highly unemployable. And I was all signed up to go work for the CIA, and I was going to do leadership analysis in the Middle East. They had come onto campus and recruited very heavily from our program. And so I thought it was pretty cool. I was going to go work for this, like, you know, intelligence community and have to come up with a fake name. And no, just kidding. But I, you know, was going to maybe go to the Middle East and be working out of one of Saddam Hussein's palaces. And, you know, that was when I'd be working for the State Department, but was going to go over there. And I ended up having a bike accident on campus at Stanford. And so here I was, this ambitious grad student. And I was biking home one night, and I came across an intersection and ended up colliding with another cyclist. He was coming up my bike lane. Neither of us had bike lights or anything, and no helmets. And we collided. I went over my handlebars and landed on the ground, could not move. I had a ton of pain in my stomach and hit my head. And this tells you where it was. 2 days earlier, I had gotten my first cell phone, right? Like just the big old clunker. This is back in 2000. And so some girls that had seen the accident started running over towards me. And the guy who hit me actually just picked up his bike and took off. And I ended up laying on the ground, knowing from being an athlete, I'm like, you don't have a whole lot of bones down there. So something internally is going on. Stanford ambulance came over because the girls used my cell phone to call 911. And of course, as a grad student, the ambulance shows up and I'm like, how much is this going to cost me to get to the hospital? And the guy said, well, Betty Ann, it may cost you your life if you don't get in. And I was like, good point. Okay. So they take me on this short little ambulance ride. I get to the ER, and for 2.5 hours, they just let me lay there, and they just thought I had gotten the wind knocked out of me. And so my stomach was actually filling with blood at that point, and I looked like I had just finished a buffet, even though I had not eaten in 8 hours. And they said, well, you can call a friend. We'll have, you'll probably be out of here in an hour. And so right about when I made that phone call, I just totally fell apart on my friend's voicemail, because I knew something was happening to me, and they weren't helping me. And so right before they were going to discharge me, I just said, look, I don't know what's going on. Like, I had no advocate. It was, 11 o'clock at night at this point. I had no advocate. And I just said, I know that something's going on in my body. I'm not leaving here until you do more tests. So they stood me up and did a chest x-ray, which if you have internal injuries, you're never supposed to move the person. And then they put me through a CAT scan. And it became a scene out of ER. I basically got wheeled out of the room, and I heard before the door shut, her kidneys and her spleen are fine. But apparently, right after the door shut, they mentioned that my liver was basically dangling in two. And so it became a scene out of ER. It was like, code 3, move to room 1, on the gurney. And next thing you know, I'm surrounded by 20 doctors, and they're all looking at me, and they just are just, they're freaking. And I'm like, well, what's going on? And they're like, well, we need you to lay, you are having massive internal bleeding. We need you to lay as still as possible and pray. Like, for 20 doctors to tell you their only solution for you is to pray, it's pretty interesting. And they said, lay still. And I thought, wow, you guys have been moving me all around, okay, but I'm just going to start praying. And they said, we're giving your body 5 minutes to stop bleeding. And if it doesn't stop bleeding internally, which they were taking my blood to test, they said, we're going in for a massive blood transfusion. We have to take out part of your liver, and we're going to go call your folks. So my parents get that phone call in the middle of the night. No one wants to get. And I said to them, I said, please just be easy on them. Don't freak them out. They live in Nevada. It's going to be the middle of a snowstorm. And they ended up calling my parents, and they said, your daughter's been in a bike accident. That was about as best bedside manner as they had. Then they were like, and we're about to take out part of her liver and do a complete blood transfusion. Are you coming down? So freaked my parents out. So they come back in, and 4 minutes into it, they take my blood, and they say, your body stopped bleeding. So no surgery necessary. Never had them have to open me up. Went into a period of a week in the ICU where they kept me under all sorts of 24-hour monitoring. And you can imagine a bunch of ER nurses are pretty excited that there's somebody in the ER who starts to get better. A lot of people go into the ER and it goes the other way, right? So I've never understood what's really going on in me. They haven't told me the extent to which my liver is actually lacerated and how serious it was. And so about 2 days in, they said, if you had been 20 years older and not an athlete, you would have died. And from that moment on, I started a journey back towards health, where I had a week in the ICU, a week on the floor of the hospital, a month in a quarantined little apartment on campus at Stanford, where they send people who normally have infectious diseases. But they put me there because they didn't want anybody to touch me. If anybody bumped me, if I stepped on a rock wrong and twisted, if I was on a bike or anything, if my liver jolted at all, they were going to have to go in and do the surgery and take out part of the liver. So my mom lived with me for a month. She went to all my classes for me because I was still in the middle of my grad program. And she came back from one of my international conflict classes, and she said, I get that they're talking about India, but I don't understand why Kashmir keeps getting brought up. Why is fashion in the world of conflict resolution? And I'm like sitting there going, don't make me laugh. That's so funny. So anyway, India and Kashmir, major conflicts, and it's a region, not a sweater. And so anyway, my mom was with me for a month. Then I had to live in my dorm for a month and not leave. So you can imagine if they move you to an inner dorm on campus and then you're the girl that never goes outside. It's pretty awesome. Like, people thought I was so weird. No, they just were like, have you ever seen her leave? Like, I would hear people walk by my door and they'd be like, have you ever seen her leave? So I had to take tests in my dorm room. I had to lay down 18 hours a day. And 9 weeks into it, right when I mean, there was such a period for me where I look back and I'm like, I have no idea what I did all day. It was like I felt like God just was with me, so present in the recovery that everything in me had turned inward to just say, you've got to get better. And it wasn't like I was sitting there going, I'd like to read a paper, or I'd like to listen to music, or gosh, I have some friends to call. It was almost like this internal turning of just knowing that I had to have everything focused on healing. So in the midst of being in the hospital, people would come to me and they would say, Betty Ann, I can't believe what this guy did to you. I mean, have you ever wanted to find him? I mean, do you have any idea of what he looked like? The Stanford police came to me and they did a character sketch and they put it on the front of the Stanford Daily and they wanted to find this guy. And it was so interesting because I could feel my body turning so inward to heal that if any iota of me was spent on frustration and bitterness and unforgiveness, I could actually feel it pulling me away from the healing that I needed. And so I would say to people, I'd say, you know, it's my responsibility to focus on getting better. It's the police's responsibility to find him. So fast forward, that meant that I did not go work at the CIA. I called them and said I need to stay around the Stanford Hospital for a year because of my liver laceration. I have some pretty crazy stories about the CIA continually finding me in random spots throughout the country for the next year. And I was like, how do you guys know where I am? So took a little while to get them off my tail. But they kept wondering if I wanted to come back and work for them. The point being that all of a sudden, what I thought was just a stop in the station, you know, train station, just, you know, kind of, hey, I had this bike injury and then I get going again. It was a complete switching of rails for me. And from that point onward, I had a period of being unemployed because of my injury. And I ended up going to work for Stanford Travel Study, which is a group that actually leads alumni tours around the world, and decided to actually say, if I care about conflict resolution, I need to just go to these countries and be with people. But in the midst of that time of just real processing around what happened, I ended up hearing Gary Haugen speak at my church. And I was sitting there as someone recovering from such a drastic injury and really feeling this sense that I was so tested all the time with people asking me, why didn't you go after that guy more? When you got back to having that little golf cart around campus to get back to your classes, you know, did you ever find him and did you just want to run over him? I mean, the things that people would say, it was really interesting. But I was like, I thought about it once or twice. But really, I just thought, isn't it interesting that once I got connected with International Justice Mission and I realized that in the developing world, if you have an issue, if you are a victim of injustice, you do not turn to the police for help. You run from the police usually because they are often part of the abuse and the violence. And I was sitting there going, wow, first of all, I can't believe that I can just turn to the police and say, I know they're doing the best that they can. They actually did stakeouts on that corner for like 3 weeks to see if they could find that guy riding his bike into campus again. They put this character sketch up. They tried to do the best that they could. So the sense that the police were actually advocating on my behalf was a sense that I had in that time period. But also that sense of what it felt like to be, in my own way, a victim of injustice, where this guy had literally almost killed me, and he just picked up his bike, and, you know, 3 weeks later, I'm wondering, does he even know what happened and how that trajectory shifted my entire life? He's probably just going about his life, has no idea. And I have to say that as the longer that I have walked in this journey of really standing against some dark injustices, I think it's very helpful for us as leaders to ask ourselves, what is it in us that so deeply connects us with this issue, right? There's a lot of human rights issues out there. There's a lot of global environmental issues out there. Why is it that the issue of human trafficking connects so deeply with your own spirit? And I don't ask that question lightly. I think I've shared that at a lot of events that we do, somebody will come up to our table and they will just say, well, I naturally need to get your information. I'm a victim of sexual assault. And that is somebody sharing something very deep about their story. And yet because of what we do, man, they are just ready to tell me that in the first 2 minutes of meeting them. And I think so I both encourage you as a leader to ask yourself, what are the ways in which and why you feel like God has really deeply connected you to this issue? And also, how do I be ready for what's going to be unearthed or scraped open for people that hear about the work we're doing? So for instance, any time that we have had one of our big awareness events, like the Freedom Summit, we have always had prayer warriors available and counselors available. So if somebody comes to the event and they actually go, holy cow, I didn't realize it, but this, you know, I think this is happening to my brother or sister, or I've been a victim of sexual assault or whatnot, to be ready for what you are scraping open. It is not about tearing at people's emotions and saying, we should all care and fight, and somehow you just leave people completely scraped open. So there's both that journey for you as a leader to ask yourself, what are the ways in which, why do you deeply connect? And I come back to this question, I have to admit, about every year, because I also say, like, what is it about me that, what about my own faith journey that in my past that I felt like, well, maybe it's because I also kind of grew up in a church environment where I felt like I really had to go do a bunch for God, right? Like, I just had to be out there and I had to do a bunch. And what does it mean for me to sit back and say, like a day at Mount Hermon yesterday, I'm not fighting for anyone today, I'm just, like, being present to God's love for me. And what does that mean for me to make sure that I'm still filled up so that I can go do the work? And I know that we hear these things in different contexts, but I think when it specifically becomes to the point of you're asking how do you advocate on behalf of other people, it's so important that you can continue to ask yourself, am I at a place where I am refueling and getting my own just soul connection with Christ? So a lot of what I care about now is when people ask us what's our role in the anti-trafficking world, in the Bay Area, we look at the groups that are doing trafficking work, and we do want to make sure that they are viable organizations, that if somebody said, I want to donate my time or I want to give money there, that they are a strong organization. But the other piece that Brian and I really care about is how are they doing just as a leadership core? You know, if I hear that they're all struggling with their families or they're, you know, I'm seeing them at events. Like, sometimes we'll have weeks where we go and, like, all of us see each other, like, six nights a week. And by the sixth night, we're like, this isn't healthy. Go home. So we're both trying to, you know, we try and hold each other accountable into saying, what does it mean for, especially like Brian and I, we're like, there's just two of us. And we're trying to get around the entire Bay Area. And we're trying to be at all these events. And so we've ended up saying, we need to train up ambassadors. We need people to understand that they can be present at events for us. And they can speak and do the same PowerPoint that we do. And so a large part of how you can actually end up, I think, sustaining is in this world of social media and webs and, you know, web technology and everything, to know that a lot of what you have, you can give away, right? Like our talks, what we say, it's not that we want to be a personality in this. It's that we want the most people to hear about what trafficking is, what suspicious activity looks like, and what numbers to call. And I remember that early on from my days at International Justice Mission. Gary Haugen, you know, he used to say, this is not about Gary Haugen. Now, granted, he's a very big figure in the movement, right? And when anybody has kind of a crew cut like that hasn't been in since the 50s, you're going to remember Gary Haugen, right? And I only say that because he will make personal jokes at himself about his hair. But he's somebody who stands as a figure that was like, this cannot be about me. It's got to be about the victims. It's got to be about the work we're doing. It's got to be about the structural change we want to see. And it's got to be about us talking about God showing up on our side in order to fight these injustices. Otherwise, we're going to get squashed like a bug. So I think the more that you get real with your own struggles and your own vulnerabilities in this and your own reasons for being connected to it, the more you see God show up just for you in this. So it's that place where your great work of hoping for change in the world also meets the place where God is wanting to transform you. And so when I first heard Gary speak, and he said, he gave this bodybuilder analogy, and he said, I was a football player, and for me, I was a basketball player, and so he and I always connected on an athletic front. And he said, you know, I'd go to the gym all the time, and I would lift a ton of weights. But the point wasn't to just lift weights and get strong. The point was to be a really good football player. So for me, it was like to lift weights to get out into the game of life. I had the strength, I had the muscle to then go out and do what I wanted to do. And he said, but you know, it was a little intimidating when you go to the gym, and you see those people in the gym who seem to have it all figured out, right? They're the bodybuilders. They're the ones in the corner with the gleaming muscles and the tight shirts, and somehow they have it all figured out of like how to be looking huge and, you know, have all this muscle and all this strength. And he said, but you know, if you think about it, with a bodybuilder, and nothing against weightlifting in this room, but he said, if you're a bodybuilder, he's like, what's it all for? It's for posing, right? You get up there and you go, and he said, and the only time that all that strength and all that momentum and all that power ever comes to bear is when there's a jam jar to be popped in the kitchen. And you run in and you're like, I got it. And so he ended that conversation by saying, my challenge to all of you is that we don't end up being bodybuilders who are just popping jam jars in the kitchen. I would suggest that all of you, by being here this weekend, by the different spheres of influence and communities you live in, you are all leaders in this movement who are saying, what can I do to flex my muscles in the game of life for those who cannot flex on their own, who are so deprived of sunlight because they're working all night long, because of and sleeping during the day, food, not being able to get food, things like that. You are literally trying to stand with muscle for people who do not have any, and who are held in places of oppression and marginalization. And my challenge to you, though, is to say, where are those places where we want to make sure that we're not just building all this? You know, I remember when I first heard it, I was like, you know, Lord, here I am recovering from this injury. I can't lift all the barbells I thought I once could because I'm just trying to recover. And yet, I feel like I've been to every Bible study. I've been in the church almost all my life. I feel like I understand your heart around so many things in the world. And, you know, just what's that next nudge for me of how I could just really get out there and flex it in the world? And boy, did he answer that prayer. I ended up going up to Gary Haugen a few months later, and he was actually just going to speak that morning, and he was on his way to the restroom, and I intercepted him. I was like, whoosh, Gary Haugen, I'm your gal for the West Coast. And he was like, well, I'm just trying to go to the bathroom. And you need to talk to that guy over there because he does the hiring. And so I ended up 2 weeks later getting flown to D.C. They interviewed me for the West Coast Director of Development. And a couple weeks later, they offered me the job. So my life went from kind of dreaming of, God, how do I flex my muscle in the world, to all of a sudden being in this position where they said, well, you're our only person west of the Mississippi, and let's just go for it. So it's been an awesome journey since then. But I mention that because I'm kind of at the 10-year anniversary of where I thought my life was moving in one direction, and God really, by physical kind of ailment, used that situation to put me on an entirely different track. Then I worked for IJM. Right when I was leaving IJM in 2007, I was noticing that I was opening up the paper, and there were raids happening in San Jose and San Francisco. And I was sitting there closing the paper and feeling like there was just silence around what to do about this issue on the domestic front. There was, and I had come from a philanthropic background too, of working for a family foundation where it was like, how do you actually give to fight trafficking in the Bay Area or locally? It's like, you can't pay off the FBI to care. And you can't, you know, pay off your local law enforcement or take them out to coffee and say, you really should care about this. So how do we actually fund the fight against trafficking? How do we stand against it? And I kept feeling like every time I'd see these things in the paper, because they were few and far between, but I'd kind of close it. And in my own heart, it was that same closing that I sensed when I worked at IJM, where people would say, you know, it's enough to think that this is happening in India and Cambodia and the Philippines and all throughout Africa. But there was this sense that when the church service ended and they finished hearing about that, they could just be like, hey, where are we all going to brunch? And let's go out. And there was a sense that this global injustice had not landed on local soil. And so a lot of my journey has been about saying, once you actually have people understand that it's hit on local soil, what I wanted to emphasize this morning is that that is not necessarily, well, I should say almost all the time, that is not good news for people who discover that first, right? You can have people who have been advocating about trafficking internationally for a long time, but the minute they start realizing that it might be in their neighborhood, what is the number one sense that it might come up? Fear, vulnerability, almost a sense of denial. And I think that that is where, when that is our subconscious response, we have to be able to respond to that and meet people, not in a place of immediately saying, you should get fired up about this, and let me tell you 5 ways you could do this. Often where we need to come in is at that soul level and say, I get that this feels vulnerable. Or let me tell you a story about how this is so close to my home. I can throw a rock at a place that I just knew got busted for prostitution. What does that make me feel like living in that neighborhood? The closer this issue has got to home, the more it has made people feel vulnerable. And so churches are the place that I feel like are the most equipped already to continue walking with people in that vulnerability. If you think about all the things we're doing online now and socially, where we just kind of listen to podcasts or we kind of do things on our own, churches are still the place where once a week people are usually gathering. And they're saying, here's what I care about, here's what I'm thinking about. Something breaks in the news that week that says, hey, here's a church on this street, and there's a brothel bust that happened right in between them. Sometimes that's the thing that's getting those churches to talk together for the first time ever. But I just suggest it by way of saying that is where our conversation about this needs to go a bit more from the intellectual of just how do we get in there and tell the traffickers this and rescue the victims and what message are we trying to send, and really saying what does the community feel? And the feeling is usually one of vulnerability, wanting to move towards a sense of denial or an understanding of just saying, you know what, I'm really glad I have that little justice team at my church because we'll let them handle this. And it really is an issue that I suggest that on a soul level, all of us as leaders in this need to be sensitive to people who you tell about this issue. A lot of them want to care, but what comes up in them is the unspoken, I'm actually freaked out. Like as soon as somebody learns about some of these issues, they're like, does this mean I should still send my kids to the mall? What about Facebook, and are my kids getting any online predators really looking at them on Facebook? And you can almost, I've had moms raise their hands when I speak, and they're like, I feel like you've given me enough information to be paranoid. And I say, you know what? That is the hump we need to get people over. You need to have enough information not to be paranoid, but to be dangerous, and to be dangerous in the best way, because you've got enough information that knows, excuse me, what to look for, and how to be effective in your own sphere of influence, but also helping them understand how they actually walk with this realization that God has opened their eyes to something that is going to impact their relationships, right? It's going to impact how they might talk to their kids about chocolate. It might impact what they have in their pantry around fair trade or what soaps and products they use. It might end up being that they start to realize they want to go to a trafficking conference, and they're like, wow, my spouse or my roommate is thinking like I'm getting all weird about this trafficking stuff, you know, or I'm really getting into it. And people can say to me, I'm really afraid of losing the connection with my husband. I'm really afraid that my kids are going to think that I'm weird and I don't know what to cook for dinner anymore because I want to make quinoa now, you know. So we have to deal with these subtle undertones of the way in which some of the ways we want to be transformed and changed by what we engage ourselves in, right? That's part of the journey in opening ourselves to God. But when it comes into a place that it is going to isolate us or alienate us from most intimately our partner or our family or our broader community or even within our church, we might be the only person who cares about this issue in their church. And you're just like, why is it that this is so huge in the eyes of God and I stand here completely alone in my own church? And so that is where we need to say, God, what are the ways in which I can actually connect with people on that soul level? Where the analogy I always love to give is, it'd be like coming in and you want to serve coffee to your church, and everybody wants a good cup of coffee in the morning, even those who are kind of like trying to get off caffeine, like myself. No, but you want to give people a good cup of coffee. But if you give it to them and it's scalding hot, no one can drink it. So if you come in the room as a human trafficking advocate and you are just like, this is the amount of clients people have to serve every day, this is the brutality of it, this is da-da-da, you are going to have people looking at you that are just like, I am so glad you care about that, and you go, because you seem to have a lot of energy. But I'm going to just like wait until that coffee gets to a place that it's just warm enough that I can drink it. And I used to have people come up to me, and they would pat me on the shoulder, and they'd be like, I am so glad that you care about trafficking, because you have a lot of energy, and you love getting out there. And I'm like, hey, here's the deal. Right now, like the evil and the darkness around this is winning, right? It's the fastest growing criminal activity in the world. In some ways, you could argue that it's like, if we don't stand against this, like if you don't join me, like it's great for you to say good for you, but if people don't join me, then we are, the bad guy's gonna win. You know what I'm saying? In the sense of, in the regard of some of the darkness around it. But I would stand here and say, even as I say that, I'm convicted to say, obviously, we see God moving. We see God's victory in the light in this issue. We know that if this was all about rescuing one person, that life alone is worth this effort. But I want to just have you understand that when people look at you and they start to say, wow, there's this Lone Ranger. Wow, there's this gal that's really going, or this guy that really knows what he's doing. We really want to invite a sense of inclusiveness and ask people to in some way join you. Because I sit there and I go, when people go, Betty Ann, you're starting to tell me that this issue is so big. Right. It's, and I say, yes, that's what's amazing. It is so big that any one person that comes to me and says they can't figure out a way to actually connect with this issue, if they give me 10 minutes, I can tell them a way in which in their life, in their sphere of influence, that they could do something to impact human trafficking around the world or in their own community. And so I guess I just, we've got to keep building the army of God's people who care about this issue. And there are people who care in our churches, and it is very important when people say, hey, you know, can I, you know, just give you money for that, or can I just pray for you? Those are not minimal things. I don't want to minimalize that. But when I worked for IJM back in 2004, literally I could kind of tell people if I came to a conference like this, I'd be like, well, you can pay or you can pray. Those were like the two options. And now there is such a spectrum of engagement of ways that you can invite people in. You can have them help you write a devotional on injustice and on what God's heart for justice means. You can have them, you know, do a play or an interpretive dance or a have them do a video on interviewing people about what they think about trafficking or just learning about it. You can host, you know, Robin's a fair trade soap woman that's made change and said, hey, I'm going to actually make soap in my house and sell it and have people understand the connection between fair trade products and slavery around the world. There's ways in which people are, you know, high school students are doing walks at their schools and they're having all sorts of fair trade fashion shows, you know, things like that. We have so many creative ways. And so I think what I wanted to hone into this morning as well was where Eugene said, we've got to get creative about our discipleship and our creative about our faith journey. I think it totally applies here. But when such an issue is so serious and so dark, we end up trying to bring our best academic game often. We're like, man, I really need to just think about the best solutions to this and the fastest because there's all these people who are being held enslaved. And the reality is some of the most creative solutions are the ways in which the most people are being either rescued or are being are learning what the signs are of being preyed upon so that potential trafficking victims don't become victims in the first place. One of the examples I'd love to give is one of the huge cases that blew this open was back when IJM did a raid in Sve Pak, Cambodia, and they learned that there were all these very young kids that were being held in prostitution, as young as 5 years old. And they were wanting to do a massive, you know, intervention. Well, it's crazy, but they had to find the people who were running the brothels, and they were just kind of like, how do we do this, and how do we get the most kids out at one time, right? So they end up deciding that they're going to go to the brothel owners and they're like, you know what, we're going to pose as Johns or sex buyers, and we're going to go in and say we're bringing like a convention of people in and we're just going to have this big sex party. And so what they ended up doing was they pulled up to this area that had all these brothels in a row with all these young children, and they had two buses. And they had the first bus with where they got all the pimps and the traffickers and the brothel madams and stuff. And they said, you know what, the men on the bus in the back want to just start kind of checking out what the kids look like and stuff, so let's put the kids on the second bus. And literally the first bus just drove to prison, and the second bus drove to the safe house. And it was just like, wow, that was easy. No, it wasn't that easy. But I'm saying that kind of creativity just freed over 30 kids in a matter of minutes. So I just want to suggest it by way of saying there are creative ways. I mean, I get goosebumps when I still tell that story because it's like that's just such a beautiful visual image. Just like, thank you very much. We will now check you into your prison hotel. And just that vision, too, of the other kids getting to go to freedom. So I guess by way of saying, I guess I wanted to share, too, that there are different ways in which each of us are going to connect with God's, you know, kind of calling and place for us in this movement. And there's another spectrum there that I want to talk about, which is that some people really want to work in what we would call the aftercare environment, right, where victims have been rescued, they are on the path towards recovery and restoration, and they're just saying, I have skills, you know, I'm a massage therapist, I'm a counselor, I want to help them learn English, whatever it might be. But they are walking with the survivors. And then on the other hand, I would say on the other end of the spectrum are people who are about advocacy and about trainings and about prevention. And you have, and I'm not saying there's a good or bad here, this is just a spectrum. spectrum of engagement. And you have folks who, like Brian and I, we get so excited to see all of you getting more mobilized this weekend that we go home from this and we are just like, yes, God, you are showing up for us in this. People care about this. Churches that have never done anything around this before are saying, what can we do to raise awareness about the fastest growing criminal activity in the world? What is the church's stance going to be against this? And then you have congresspeople that will call us and, or the White House calling us and saying, hey, we'd love your perspective on what you're doing in the Bay Area. And we're like, whoa, God, this is huge. But you understand that in that whole movement, I'm not necessarily daily hanging out with the people who are the very survivors who I'm fighting for. But there's a way in which when I touch point a lot of my friends in this community who are survivors, and we even have an email, or I see them once a quarter at an event, that to me is I'm like, yes, that is the touch point that I know my friends that I am fighting for. But I am stoked to get people mobilized in this movement. And then you have people who are like, if I don't keep this straight in front of me every day and work with an organization that I am with those survivors, then I kind of lose touch of what my call might be in this. And so I'm just saying that it's important for you as a leader in this to ask yourself, is it around prevention, advocacy, trainings, you know, kind of the at-risk interventions on the streets, walking the streets and meeting the different victims in the midst? Is it working as a lawyer and offering pro bono services? Is it as a social worker and starting to work around counseling and some of the, is it moving into the realm of saying, I am going to actually be a survivor advocate or working face-to-face with the survivors? And it is really important for us each to define that space, because if you really want to, your heart is to be, say, even like, say, writing poetry or doing an art class with survivors, but you're hanging out with us, like doing an advocacy walk, I mean, you'll be there. That's cool. But how about for the long haul? What is going to keep you in this sense of staying plugged in? And this is where I love the example of Jesus just saying, you know, I am the vine and you are the branches. There's a sense that when we are on such a long journey of fighting an injustice that isn't just going to go away tomorrow, you really need to consider and prayerfully consider where you connect in with this particular injustice in a way that is both the place where you feel it is the place where your gifting and your skill set and all that is best utilized, but also where's the place that keeps you tender? Where's the place that keeps you open to the transformation in yourself? Because there are ways in which, you know, I've seen people kind of show up in this and they say, well, you know, Betty Ann, I'm going to work in this field for like 2 years and then I'm going to go get a real job. And I'm like, what is that? Like, you know, I don't think that God's heart for this issue is about give certain parts of our lives to this and then say, you know, check that off. I kind of, you know, I did my time. This is definitely not about doing our time. This is about showing up and caring about something that God has always cared about. And it just happens to manifest itself in our generation in the issue of human trafficking. I also think that when people come to us, the movie last night pointed out a lot of churches that come to us, they say, Betty Ann, trafficking is the gateway issue into which we are actually talking about darkness and issues within our own church. So a lot of pastors have come to us and have said, you know, it's interesting to me that anti-trafficking, while we're talking about really getting into the rescue of others and how this happens and how you rescue people, that we're also looking at the demand side of how many folks in our congregation are looking at pornography, how many have admitted to having affairs or a sexual addiction. And so churches are starting to say, well, maybe our response to the anti-trafficking issue is we're going to actually set up a sex addiction support group. And that's not at the initial level, there'd be a lot of people that are like, I don't get the connect. You know, they'll kind of be like, I don't get it. You were going to be out like doing rescues with the police and now you're having a sexual addiction, you know, group. And it's like, that is awesome, because that is that church admitting, like opening its own stuff to say, what is this issue bringing up for our community? And so, and then other churches, I would say, you know, they've been working in the schools for years or something, but they feel like they've been more putting a Band-Aid on things. They've been painting the walls and building structures, but they're like, we don't seem to be making connection with the the kids at the school or the teachers. And all of a sudden, the issue of human trafficking comes along, and they're like, we are getting mentors into those schools. We are talking in the classes about what healthy relationships look like and what it means to actually be preyed upon. And we're finding out that these kids, when they're walking home after school, are getting traffickers that drive up and say, hey, you're pretty, and hey, can I buy you a milkshake? And they're actually seeing that these kids are saying no to these traffickers, and they're actually finding more connection and more community within the schools that they've been working in for years. So I also would say that, you know, as part of the how do we sustain in this is definitely not to present ourselves as the new issue, right? You come into a missions meeting, and this church has had tons of missions work going on in the past, and you're like, let me tell you about how massive and how important human trafficking is, because I can make that case, right? But the reality is you're coming into churches that have had long-time prayerful discussions about missional issues within their church, and they are saying, we are involved in evangelism in this part of the world, and we are involved in relief and development efforts to end extreme poverty in these areas, and we are looking at our local missions and schools and this and that, and you're coming in here and saying, you know, human trafficking, well, it's got to be that we're a bridge builder, that you actually help them see that their work with homeless folks, that you could say that is an at-risk population. They are now at risk of being trafficked. And then you have foster care, and there's a huge connectivity between churches who have cared so much about foster care youth and to realize that they're aging out of the system and that they are turning to the streets to make money, or that within the foster care homes there has been so much sexual abuse that they say, well, why wouldn't I just go get paid for it? And how many, like right now it's up to 60 to 70% of all domestic trafficking cases in the U.S. have a connection with the foster care system. So it's helpful to help your faith community understand the connectivity with missional outreaches that they've already had going on, and to encourage them to introduce a new human trafficking element of the current partners they already have. So by way of closing, I'd love to just point out that, and I know Brian mentioned this briefly in his talk yesterday, but if you look at Micah 6:8, and it says, you know, he has shown me, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of thee, to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with thy God. If you look at the walk humbly with thy God, and let's say I were to put three bubbles up here right now. I'm a big whiteboarder, so I don't have one today. But the first bubble is that walk humbly, which involves evangelism, or people could say spiritual formation, right? And there's a way in which the church response to that has been to say, we need to sponsor organizations who go out and do the evangelism around the world, right? What are some great evangelism organizations that we know of? I'm thinking Campus Crusade for Christ, Frontiers, who YWAM, Wycliffe. Those are all organizations that have responded to that need of people needing to hear the word and how do you walk in your faith, right? So there are some numbers around that, but just roughly, there's about $2.8 billion a year that get put into the North American church response to trying to fight, you know, kind of have everybody know what the word of God is and to walk humbly. Then you get into the relief and development, kind of the love mercy, which is really building the house, putting the shoes on the orphans. I'm thinking of Samaritan's Purse, Habitat for Humanity, World Vision. What are some other groups that are just doing that relief work? Compassion. Yep. So those are groups that the North American Christian, evangelical Christian response has been, you know, it's still around like $1 billion that a year everybody gives to fight those issues. And I say fight, but I'm sorry, I mean uplift those people doing that kind of work to get out there and say, we need those homes, we need those. But then there's the act justly circle, right? Which is how does the church respond to this call to walk in God's justice? And what is so amazing is you say, God's heart for justice, you say, well, this would be looking at more of the systems, right? Instead of just building the home, it would say, why does that people group never have housing? It would be saying, instead of just putting the shoes on the orphans, it would be saying, is it in the best interest of those kids to be in a group home? It's the question of how do you get those kids back into families? Those kind of things. Foster care. It's groups that are working in the justice world, like an IJM, like a Hagar, like the groups that I'm mentioning that are locally, like us with the BAATC. But it's trying to have a justice response to looking at the structural differences that need to happen in order for these injustices to not be perpetuated. But when we were doing this study, the number of how much the North American church was pouring into how do you act justly, how do you do justice as a church, It was around 20 to 40 million. So you've got over 2 billion here, you've got 1 billion here, and then you've got like 25 million here. And so I say that by way of saying when we are trying to stand in our churches, in our communities, and invite people to come along with us in this prayerful posture of saying, how do we act justly? And how does that impact how we live our lives? And how does that impact how we as a church live our communal life? It is awesome to know that we're not the only ones asking that question. That is the question of the church today, is how do we act justly? And I would say that 40 years ago, you could look at those bubbles that we say are now so well populated with those other organizations. The church was asking the question at that point, how do we get the word of God around the world, right? And then about 20 years ago, you started seeing things like Doctors Without Borders and all these groups starting to pop up that were just, and you know, I'm thinking of even Samaritan's Purse, Habitat for Humanity. Those are all within the last 20 to 40 years that those have become a Christian response to saying, we are going to meet the compassionate needs that are out there in the world. So for us to now stand here today and say, I've got questions about how we do this, I think God is saying, yes, that is exactly where we've got you, but you're not the only one asking the question. And so a conference like this weekend helps us hold that we have the example of how those other two bubbles have been filled over time by God's goodness and vision and people of faith. But we stand now and say, what is our role and what is our piece? And as we know that we've got this DNA inkling towards understanding God's heart for justice, what does it mean not only for me as an individual, but for me as the collective church? So this way of saying you're standing in a place where many other people are asking this, and our posture can be, Lord, help keep me in that tender place as a branch off of your vine where I am both looking to be effective and a momentum mover, but I'm also saying, what is the place in me that stays tender to understanding that there are ways in which you want to transform me? And when I've heard this analogy from a friend of mine at IJM where he says, you know, Betty Ann, as long as you're trying to stand in this issue and you start saying, yes, I'm going to fight this issue, but I have not really attended to my own, you know, say, needs of my family or my parents. And yeah, I watched all these videos on human trafficking, but I haven't really processed why I'm staying up at night and why I'm wrestling with a certain particular part of it. I'm shoving that in there. You know, I'm actually kind of knowing I'm burned out and I'm actually feeling isolated and I don't do as much with my friends, but I'm just going to kind of trust that God will move me through that. And I'm not really going to seek any, you know, I'm thinking I'm seeing some websites and whatnot, or I'm, you know, playing these video games that I know aren't good for me, but I just kind of haven't sought any accountability on that. And you just keep putting it in the closet. And then, you know, what happens is that closet, I mean, we're pretty good at, like, pretty good organizers, and that closet could, like, it could be a while before it's going to get full. But I tell you, the fuller that closet gets when we don't deal with these things in real time is that then when that closet does burst and that door breaks off, it not only is going to spew stuff out that is going to knock you out and make you really ineffective in the fight that you actually want to stand for, but it is also going to spew out and hit other people in your life, whether that's your roommates, your spouse, your friends, your kids. And so my thing is, let's not get to that point where we push stuff in so much that when it falls out, it's going to knock us out and make us completely passed out and ineffective. Let's actually trust God with saying, God, I need to make these elements of my own self-care part of my daily walk with you, part of my daily, how am I doing with the standing against the darkness? So that we've got to believe that it is God's power and God's light and God's joy that works within us to help us stand against this. This is not by our own willpower, but it's by continually asking for God to show up on our behalf. So let me just close with that and offer up a prayer for us this morning. Father, we are grateful for time to stop and to know that as we fight, Lord, it's impossible for us as humans to continually stay with our fist clenched, Lord, for hours, days, months on end. Lord, we know that the posture of ourselves towards you and towards your world that you have such compassion for, Lord, needs to be one of open hands. Lord, ones in which we can be open to receive from you, ones in which we can trust, Lord, that we need to lay things down before you, and ways, Lord, that we can offer up our prayers in a posture of putting our hands together, Lord, in prayer, saying that without you working your power in us and through us, God, that we are ineffective in this fight. And so constantly, Lord, may you bring us back to the place as leaders, that you would send us out with a blessing from this place, Lord, of not only a sense of vision for how you would love for us to step into and walk alongside the lives of our friends and our families and those who are caring about this issue, but Lord, that you would also help pull us aside, bring us back to that place of understanding how important it is for us to reorientate ourselves towards understanding what you are doing in us, how this holds a mirror, Lord, to what you want us to see about ourselves, what you want us to learn about you in us. So may this morning together, Lord, may our conversation be glorifying to you. May it help us unearth some new things potentially, Lord, that we can consider as we look to continue to hold your hand as we walk forward in this fight. Amen.